Just a few things about Dr. Fielding. He was educated at Cambridge at the same time that Whittle was there. And following that, he joined Unilever on the second day that war commenced, actually. But he was recruited into Powerjets in 1940, and he'll tell you more about that, and was there until May 1946. After Powerjet's demise, actually, he then turned to Ruston Hornsby in 1946 and was there right through to 1959 as engineering director. In fact, you've been there today, in effect, and has met one or two of ex-Rolls-Royce colleagues like Chris Buck and David Lendon. Following that, he had a brief spell with Hawker Siddeley, and then at Davy Ashmore, where he became group technical director. Following that, he was headhunted by the British Standards Institute and became director general for the last 11 years. He's now retired, but runs Fielding Associates Limited and is kept extremely busy. And he's just telling me he's got 17 grandchildren as well, which will now keep him busy. Anyway, without more ado, let me introduce Dr. Bob Fielding. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Chairman. Well, Chairman, thank you very much for your introduction. And may I say straight away, what a pleasure it is to meet so many friends tonight. Harry Pearson. Lovely to see you, Harry. All the things we've done over God knows how many years. And Bill Brownhill. Just two, and several others. Well, now, coming on to my lecture formally, I'd like to begin by acknowledging the great help I've had from many people. First of all, Gordon Lewis, of your trust, has provided my slides, which I believe he in turn got from Stanley Hooker. My videos were recopied for me by the photographic section at Pistock. Many people, including Frank Armstrong, read my original text when this talk was given to the Royal Aeronautical Society and made some very helpful corrections. Indeed, Sir Frank himself has done that too. So I'm very grateful to all these people. And I'd like to say this at the very start of my talk so that I can end up with a real conclusion. Well now, the development of jet propulsion and the aircraft gas turbine in Britain has two main lines. One began in 1926 when Dr. A. A. Griffiths, who was then at the RAE, proposed the use of a gas turbine as an aircraft power plant. Now that was going to be a prop jet. This line of development ended up by leading to the Metropolitan Vickers F2 jet engine, which was developed into the Sapphire and its derivatives. Our story began 2 years later in 1928 when Frank Whittle was a cadet at Cranwell. Each term, the cadets were required to write an essay or thesis, and in his fourth and final term, Whittle chose as his subject future developments in aircraft design. Quite brave for a young 20-year-old. He concluded that if very high speeds were to be combined with long range, it would be necessary to fly at very great heights, where low air density would greatly reduce resistance in proportion to speed. Now, he was thinking in terms of speed of 500 miles an hour, whereas at that time, the top speed of RAF fighters was about 150 miles an hour. So he was, in one jump, proposing a more than 3-to-1 increase in speed, which I think was most visionary. Whittle concluded that the conventional piston engine and propeller combination was unlikely ever to meet his requirements of flying at 500 miles an hour and altitude. The following year, whilst he was attached to the Central Flying School at Wittering, he conceived the idea of using a turbine to drive a compressor and produce a propelling jet. And he explained this to one of the instructors at Wittering, Flight Lieutenant W.E.P. Johnson, who later joined us at Powerjets, And Johnston had been trained as a patent agent before he joined the RAF. So he said to Whittle, well, look, you ought to have a patent for this. So Whittle took out his first patent in 1930, and I'm going to show you a slide of the drawing of the engine and the cycle that went in that. Could we have the first slide, please? And the light's down. You can probably see it, actually, quite well like that. Here is the cycle diagram, you see. A normal pressure volume diagram with intake at D, compression, heating, constant pressure, expansion, and then exhaust. That's sort of textbook stuff. But the engine is fascinating. You see, even in 1930, he was proposing the use of a combination of an axial and centrifugal compressor stage. He had straight-through combustion, and in this drawing a two-stage turbine, and some rather funny little propelling jets at the end. But I think you'll agree that that was quite incredibly far-sighted. Well, being a very loyal serving officer, he reported this to the Air Ministry, but was told that they had no official interest in the patent, and there was no suggestion that it should be put on the secret list. So that was the start. Well, Whittle tried hard to interest the existing engine companies. Could we have the lights for a bit, please? In his ideas, but without success. They all thought they were much too futuristic. And I think, to be fair, one has to point out that at the time it was the height of the 1930s depression, and money was very tight everywhere. I mean, most of the managements were just having to scrape and scrape to keep their companies together at all. So something so radical as this would have seemed right off the end of the spectrum, as it were. Anyway, Whittle was very depressed by this, and he said he gave up hope of ever getting the idea to a practical stage, but from time to time did some paperwork and calculations on his schemes. The breakthrough occurred in May 1935, when he was at Cambridge University as an engineer officer taking the honours degree course, the TRIPOS course. And he was approached by two ex-RAF officers whom he'd known, Mr. R.D. Williams and Mr. J.C.B. Tinling, who said to him that they thought they might be able to scrape together some money to get the jet engine project going. They'd had some negotiations with some merchant bankers called O.T. Falcon Partners, and to cut a long story short, Falcons, who had some very intelligent and broadly educated people on their staff, hired a consulting engineer called M.L. Branson to look at Whittle's proposals. And Branson wrote a report, which was published in February 1970 in the Proceedings of the Royal Aeronautical Society. And I really commend that to any of you who haven't seen it as the most remarkable document. In spite of the objections made by everybody, Branson came down firmly in favor of Whittle's ideas, and so much so that O.T. Falk produced the princely sum of £2,000, on the strength of which the first engine design and manufacture was ordered from the old BTH company, the British Thomson Houston Company in Rugby. £2,000 to start to build an aero engine. It's quite incredible. But this happened. Anyway, a contract was placed with BTH, who agreed to do the work to design and build the prototype engine on a cost-plus basis. And this was placed even before the formal incorporation of Powerjets Limited. Now, Whittle was in a problem because he was just coming up to his final exams at Cambridge, which he really wanted to get a good result in. And he did end up by getting first-class honours, but he had to burn both ends of the candle to do it. So, while the design was being developed by the BTH, Bramson supervised a lot of the detail. The drawing work started in April 1936, and the engine if we could have the next slide, please, in its first form. That engine was built in the spring of 1937 and ran on the 12th of April that year in the main turbine test shop of the BTH on a gallery on the first floor, and the exhaust was just pushed through an open window. In fact, an artist's impression of the whole thing is in one of the books I have here, you may like to look at afterwards. Well, here it is. The exhaust here, the compressor with a gearbox here, and then this immense snail shell outlet, which had the combustion chamber here, some corner vanes there, and a sight window there to see whether the pilot flame was alight. And Whittle has described the first run of this engine. I mean, this was only really to prove the components, the compressor and the turbine. Quite obviously, that configuration would never get into an aeroplane. But there was so little knowledge about the combustion, where intensities of more than 10 times as great were being required as had been done in the best boiler combustion practice up till then, that this arrangement was felt to be wise. And the initial combustion chamber was designed by a firm in Edinburgh called Laidlaw Drew and Company. Well, anyway, Whittle described vividly the first run of the first engine, which you may know, that the pilot jet was lit at 1,000 RPM. He gave the signal to raise the revs and light the main jet, which lit. And then a second or two later, there was a sort of sound. And the revs built up extremely rapidly to what was estimated to be 8,000 RPM. And Whittle, of course, immediately shut the throttle. And he was the only person who didn't escape. Conyngham, the chief engineer of BTH, who was there, described how he immediately darted into a large turbine casing which was nearby. he'd had overspeeds on steam turbines in his time. Anyway, to cut a long story short, there were several disastrous runs like that until it was found that the sort of typical engineering. There was an elementary mistake in the pipework, which led to a dribble of fuel getting into this combustion chamber here, draining to the bottom of this snail shell, and that drain leak went on the whole time the fuel pump was running, whether the main fuel valve was open or closed, owing to faulty pipework. So, of course, a great sort of lake of unburned kerosene built up in here, and as soon as the gas velocity got up, with the flame coming around the corner and so on, you had a totally uncontrollable situation. Well, anyway, that was put right. But the whole affair had caused so much alarm in the BTH management that they rusticated power jets to a disused factory they had at Lutterworth, which had been a foundry making small components for them, an iron foundry, about which I'll say more in a moment. But the whole operations had to be transferred there. Now, Whittle's approach to developing this engine had been that he wanted to test the compressor and the turbine separately, but there simply wasn't money for that. I mean, today everyone does this, as you all know very well, but with these incredibly small resources, there was nothing for it but just to have a bash and build the whole engine, which he did. And this very first engine at least showed that it was self-driving and it produced a bit of thrust, but it was some little time before the combustion was sorted out. However, the Air Ministry helped the project by placing Whittle on the special duty list so that he didn't have to go off and do his ordinary RAF duties and he could really spend his whole time on the engine. And that was a very great help. And later on, they also asked for, gave him a contract to write a report on his early tests and draw conclusions. Now, go to the next slide. The engine was reconstructed. I think, could we have the lights a bit down for this slide, please? The engine was reconstructed twice, and this is the third reconstruction. The second reconstruction involved very long combustion chambers, but that only operated for a short time before this form is evolved, which you can see now is very much the form of the original flight engine. With the 10 combustion chambers, reverse flow combustion chambers, these diffuser pipes, which we used then, and the jet exhaust passing through the wall of the Lutterworth Works, which had had this special circular hole bricked into it. And it just blew out into some rather shaky corrugated iron of the Wycliffe foundry next door. Well, this was the condition which the engine was in when I arrived in June 1940. And I just make a brief digression, which I promised the chairman I would do, of how I happened to get to bar jets, which was rather unusual. At Cambridge University, they had, in those days, and I think they still do, a very good appointments board, who took a real interest in all the engineering students. And I rather chummed up with Mr. Van Grutten, who ran this, and he said to me, look, Fielden, what are you going to do in your long summer vacation? And I said, well, I've worked with BTH already, I've got a bit of practical experience, but I'd like to see something on the continent. Do you think you could get me into Bern, Bavaria, in Baden, in Switzerland? So he said he'd try, and he did. And I went as what they called a volunteer, which meant I didn't pay anything. In those days, there was still premium apprenticeships, so you had to pay to learn engineering in the works. But equally, they didn't pay me, and they gave me a very free run. I went with an old matchless motorbike I had, and I spent quite a part of the time doing foreigners on various things that went wrong with said motorbike. But that's, by the way, again, very good practical training. Well, during the time I was there, I was asked to do some really technician's work on one of the prototype Velox boilers that Brown Bavaria built. Now that was a most remarkable engineering development for its time. It had an axial flow compressor, one of the very first in any application, which was driven by an axial flow turbine, and the air from the compressor was passed through a preheater and then into the boiler, where the combustion took place at 3 atmospheres. Now, going to this condition, there was a much higher rate of heat transfer to the boiler tubes than you would get in an atmospheric boiler, which made the boiler much more compact and also made it able to get up steam more quickly. The combustion products passing through the tubes, of course, were cooled, so that the inlet temperature to the turbine, which drove the compressor, was only about 550°C, which was really very moderate, and the materials available at that time were adequate for that. So this was a sort of gas turbine, and if you were lucky, the large generator fitted on the turbo compressor shaft would actually produce a bit of surplus power, but it was used primarily for starting it up, and it wasn't necessarily expected to be much more than self-driving. Anyway, after joining Unilever, we were all issued by cards from the Central Register of Scientific and Technical Expertise, on which we had to record our experience. And I really had almost no experience at that time, but I put down my little time at the BTH and my time at Brown Bavaria and the fact I'd worked on the Velox boiler. And so it said, what are you specialized in? I said, probably most in boilers, but not very highly specialized. Anyway, to the eternal credit of the people concerned, they picked up this entry and said, well, now here's an unusual bird. He's actually seen a gas turbine. Why not try him out on power jets? So I got a green card from the Labour Exchange in Port Sunlight, which said you are to go to Power Jets Limited, Lederwood Works, Lutterworth Rugby, on, I forget the date, about the 20th of May, 1940. And the clerk in the Labour Exchange, handing me this, said, oh, I expect it's a new sort of carburetor jets. Well, I had heard about Whittle's work when I was a student, and I had other thoughts. When I got to the works, the then managing director, Lawrence White, L.L. White, said to me as his first question, "Well, have you any idea what we're doing here?" And I said, "Well, could it be the combination of the gas turbine with jet propulsion?" And White really turned white. He said, "How do you know?" And I said, "Well, when I was at university, there was quite a lot of talk amongst the undergraduates about this. There was no secrecy on the work at that time." Anyway, he immediately produced an Official Secret Act form and said, "Look, sign that quick." I did that. In fact, I joined Power Jets the following month, having made my peace with Unilever, as best as might be. But I mean, in any case, this was an order. This was wartime. Then had 6 years of the most exciting work, better than any young engineer could ever hope for. The conditions in Ladywood Works were very rudimentary. And I always feel, with hindsight, it's most remarkable that things had progressed as far as they had. Stanley Hooker described Whittle's office at that period as being rather like a rabbit hutch overlooking the railway. And that's, I think, quite a fair expression of what it was. However, in spite of these conditions, we got on and were very much... could we have the slide back on, please? Were very much held up by combustion problems. This version of the engine had vaporizing combustion system working on the primus stove principle. They had a short life only before the jets got very uneven and the flame really got to, well, the tubes usually, the vaporizing tubes usually burned through. So that was very unsatisfactory. And you can see the conditions of the combustion test rig. Here is a test combustion chamber its igniter plug. Spare bottle of kerosene there, a Tuttle pump, motor driven there, and there we are. That's what we had. The air came from a low pressure blower. This is the air feed pipe here, and the exhaust just went out into the air there, and we used to hand traverse thermocouples across that to see what sort of a temperature distribution we were getting. Well, Heath Robinson to end it all, and at times the ground here was really, I'm not exaggerating, inches deep in kerosene. It's quite a miracle we never had a major fire. There were fire extinguishers, but I think if it had ever got going, they would never put it out. Right, well, there is the W1 engine, as completed. It's just on its way down to the Gloucester Aircraft Works at Hucklecote. Here is a picture of the aircraft, the E-2839, which I dare say many of you will know, because the original prototype is now in the Science Museum. That was designed by the team under George Carter at the Gloucester Aircraft Company, and I think was absolutely brilliant, bearing in mind that there was zero background on which to work. You can see that it's a single-seater aircraft with the air duct dividing on either side of the cockpit through initially two radiators, which proved to be far bigger than were needed for the water cooling of the turbine around the turbine disk on the W1 engine. The engine had two inlets, the forward one and the aft one there, double-sided impeller, and these reverse flow combustion chambers, and the very long jet, which expanded well over an inch between cold and hot. here the aircraft is, and you may be able to see some thermal paint stripes all down the fuselage from the engine compartment rearwards, and there were some more along the top, which actually I painted myself while we were getting ready for the first taxi and trials. And we were all naturally scared, just nobody knew whether the heat from the jet pipe would get a little bit uncomfortably hot for the aluminium fuselage. As a matter of fact, not a single one of the thermoprene patches changed color at all. So the whole thing was perfectly safe. Because part of the Gloucester concept had been to have a steady flow of air through from the inlet right through to an annulus round the jet exhaust, so that there was a circulation of air all the time to prevent the building up of hot spots, and of course the jet was lagged as well. we were so held up with these vaporizer combustion chambers until the autumn of October 1940, when we built some experimental combustion chambers to the design of Mr. I. Lubbock and his team of the Shell Company. They had pressure jet burners, some very ingenious designs due to J.R. Joyce, a swirler to stabilize the flame, which is a well-known technique, of course, now, and some stub pipes to admit dilution air into the body of the combustion chamber and give you a reasonably even traverse at outlet. Well, these chambers ran extremely well from the first trial, and really, without them, I don't know what would have happened to these flight trials. We were just exactly in time. Well, now, I've got a video of the first flight, but I want just for a moment to describe the taxiing trials which were made with the aircraft in this unpainted condition. Gloucester's chief test pilot was Mr. P.A.G. Sayre, who sadly was later killed in a typhoon. And he visited Lutterworth and handled the engine controls on the test bed to get some idea of its characteristics. After the first taxiing run, Whittle reported, and I'm quoting this from his book, we started up the engine on the afternoon of the 7th of April 1941 after rain, and the airfield was very sodden, and it required at least 12,000 RPM before the airplane would even start moving, and at 13,000 RPM it would only achieve about 20 miles an hour, which was pretty disappointing. And Whittle said, "The look of disappointment on Jerry Fair's face was obvious. He evidently thought the engine would never develop enough urge to get the aeroplane off the ground. We were not worried, because we knew how rapidly the thrust increased at the upper end of the engine speed range, and this engine was authorized to go up to 16,000. I, meaning Whittle, assured Jerry that with increased engine speed he would find things very different. He did not look convinced. The next morning, we removed the throttle stop and adjusted the relief valve in the fuel line to give a maximum engine speed of 15,000 RPM. With this limit, I, meaning Whittle, made a few taxiing runs in which I reached a maximum speed of about 60 miles an hour. It was a thrilling experience for more reasons than one. It was clear that we would not be short of thrust when we used the permissible maximum of 16,000 RPM. Also, the complete absence of vibration, the big reduction in noise as compared with conventional aircraft, the excellent view from the cockpit, and the simplicity of the controls all added up to an impressive combination of characteristics. I felt that the engine instruments left something to be desired, but otherwise, so far as one could judge from a mere taxiing run, everything seemed very satisfactory indeed." And he went on, this was the very great moment. Sayre then did a little taxiing with the same speed limit on the engine. After lunch, we increased the speed limit to 16,000 RPM. With this setting, Sayre taxied off to the downwind edge of the airfield. This action caused us to suspect that he intended to do more than merely trundle over the grass. Though we had warned him that the engine was thoroughly unairworthy, it had never been intended for flight in the first place, and it had a number of misventures on the test bed, which had rendered it even less fit to fly than when first built. Sayre turned into the wind, increased the engine speed to the maximum permitted, while holding the aeroplane back with the brakes. He then released the brakes rapidly gained speed. We saw his elevators go up in an effort to get the tail down. He was a little too successful in this because the tail blister struck the ground and the aircraft got a bit of a dent which remained for some time, I could add. And the aeroplane pitched forward onto his nose wheel again. Nevertheless, a second or two later, he left the ground and after being airborne for about 200 yards, landed. Sayre taxied back and repeated the performance twice more, the third takeoff being very clean and smooth. Each time, the airborne distance was 200 to 300 yards. Well, I remember that occasion vividly because I had the job of installing the engine or supervising the installation of the engine in the prototype aeroplane. And standing beside me was the number two test pilot of Gloucester's, who will appear on one of my videos shortly. And sadly, he died recently. He, having seen these hops, turned to me and said, "Bob, thank God it flew straight." So I said, "Well, why ever not?" And he said, "Well, we've all seen balloons. You know, you let them go and they go all over the place. We've seen compressed air jets in the shop. If they stick on and you drop them, they squib around out of control. We thought your mean jets was going to be like that." Well, all I can say is, what a brave man to be contemplating flying this aeroplane if he was living under such terrible misapprehensions. That was. Well, I merely said, well, we never had those anxieties because we knew little about Newton's laws. Well, now, all was ready for the flight trials about a month later, and the aircraft had been given its proper coat of paint and looked like that then, with his P for prototype on the side, and was transported from Huckleford, the lost aircraft, to Cranwell, which was chosen, A, because it was fairly remote, and B, because there was a very long runway there which had been used before the war for the short mail tests of the Pickerback aeroplane, the very long distance, the Mayo long-range monoplane. There was this very long runway available, which actually our aeroplane only used a very small amount of, but that was one of the reasons for choosing Cranwell. I would like to read now Whittle's account of the first flight on the 15th of May, 1941, which is as follows. While the E-28 taxied to the extreme eastern end of the runway, a group of us went by car to a point about 400 yards along the runway. Sayre was in position at about 7:40 p.m., bearing in mind there was then double summer time in the war. He ran the engine up to 16,500 rpm against the brakes. He then released the brakes, and the aeroplane quickly gathered speed and lifted smoothly from the runway after a run of about 600 yards. It continued to the west in a flat climb for several miles and disappeared from view behind cloud banks. After several minutes, we could only hear the smooth roar of the engine. Then it came into sight again, and it made a wide circuit preparatory to landing. As Sayre came in, it was obvious that he had complete confidence in the aeroplane. He approached in a series of gliding turns as though he had flown the machine for hundreds of hours. Those of us who were pilots knew that he felt completely at home. He made a perfect landing at the far end of the runway and came to a stop somewhat short of where we were standing. The flight had lasted 17 minutes. He taxied towards us, stopped, and gave us a thumbs-up sign. We, of course, rushed to shake him warmly by the hand. Well, that was a perfectly marvelous flight. And, of course, quite a number of people at Cranwell saw it, and the rumors that got around about how the aircraft operated were legion. Some said it had a Merlin inside, which ran a blower. Others that it sucked itself through the sky like a Hoover. I won't bore you with any more. The attitude of the Air Ministry I still find absolutely inexplicable. There was no want of communication on the power jet side. Flight Lieutenant Johnson, who by then was on the strength of power jets, put on his uniform and went up to the Air Ministry and made a most impassioned plea that they should send a proper photographic unit, but they didn't. They did, in fact, take some photographs of the taxiing trials, but those were only stills, just of the aircraft. But that was officialdom as it was then. Things went extremely well, and I must say, the 10 hours flying was completed with only the most minor inspections. Sir William Hawthorne now, was watching the combustion side of things very carefully, and he and Geoffrey Bone put boroscopes through the burner holes. One burner was removed and the boroscope was put in to see where the carbon was forming in the combustion chambers, which of course, when the aircraft was at altitude, were operating under conditions which we had no means of testing them at ground level. And nothing was found. And in fact, the 10 hours flying was completed without really any mishap of any nature whatever. And I think this is one of the most notable engineering achievements of this century. And it reflects great credit on the teams responsible for both the engine and the airframe. Could we have the lights on now, please? The very successful completion of the flight test program led to a great upsurge in interest in jet propulsion, and really the whole industry seemed to be beating a path to power jet's door. And I was by then in charge of testing, and was doing special test runs for people from the old Bristol Engine Company, Frank Ona and Tabate, Holford came too, from de Havilland, Eric Molt and others, also some Americans came at that time. My personal regret is that we didn't carry on with the W1 engine, which subsequent events showed, perhaps more by accident than design, I have to say. But nevertheless, it avoided some of the troubles which hit us with Whittle's redesigned, much more powerful engine with lower frontal area, which took the next 2 years, really, to get going properly. And it was 2 vital years that were lost. If we'd only put the W1 engine, which admittedly was light on thrust, but would have developed in no time in production, I believe, with some adequate resources put onto it, compared with the minuscule resources we had at power jets. But that was not to be. When the Americans came, they were from General Electric, I had to show them around the test house and explain things to them. And it was very interesting that one of them commented to me, "Say, we've had the turbocharger for 20-odd years applied to aero engines, but God damn it, none of us ever thought of putting a combustion chamber between the compressor and the turbine, which is your engine." And that was Whittle's great contribution. I mean, it is extraordinary, really, when you think of it. But that was just a fact, one of those engineering omissions. The W1X engine was sent out to the States with Dan Walker, who was chief test engineer of power jets, and 2 fitters, and went to the Lynn Works of General Electric in Lynn, Massachusetts, which was quite close to Boston. And I went there a few years ago, and they've got outside the works one of the early I-1 engines, which they built, which were based entirely on the W1A. And there it is, a great tribute to Sir Frank. This engine, the American equivalent, was installed. Could we have the next slide, please? In the Bell XP-59A aircraft, which was flown at the Muroc Desert Airfield, and very quickly got the Americans into military jet propulsion. And you will see later on one of my videos Whittle's account of this, how really at the end of the day the Air Ministry simply gave the jet engine to the Americans without getting any sort of significant or proportional return. However, well, I referred to the W-2B. There was an intermediate step, the W-2 engine, which we had a rather disastrous time in because we burst an impeller due to a faulty forging. And I was in charge of that test. I remember vividly the impeller burst at 8,000 RPM, which was less than half the design speed of the engine. And we had four people in the test cell because the engine was, as we thought, only idling. Now, I'm quite sure today people are more careful, but in these early days, we were not. When this impeller burst, the only injuries, thank God, were one man, my colleague Bill Podmore, got a little bit of aluminium in his nose, and somebody else got also a very minor injury. We could have had four dead bodies. And after that, we were very much more careful. We made all the instrumentation remote, and got really more of a, what you would call a modern test setup. Well now, the W-2B engine was designed for a static thrust of 1,800 pounds, but it was agreed to work for a lower figure of only 1,600 pounds. If we could have the lights a bit dim now, please. The engines would be used in the Meteor. Here he is, still a very lovely aeroplane. And the last remaining one, being operated by Martin Baker, was flown just a year ago at the Midlands Air Museum in Coventry for some great celebrations we had for the anniversary, the 50th anniversary of the first flight. Well, there were many ups and downs, and much time was lost in an unhappy collaboration with the Rover Company, and Whittle wrote about the year 1942 that it presented a very gloomy picture, illuminated only by two bright spots. The Powerjet's W-2500, which is our successor engine to the W-2B, and the de Havilland H-1, which later became the Goblin. The Metropolitan Vickers F-2 might also have been accounted as one of the bright spots had this engine been considered to be had the engine not been considered to be in a very preliminary stage with no provision for production. After the Rolls takeover of the previous Rover facilities at Barnoldswick, things really began to hum. It was the team led by Dr. Hooker with Mr. J.P. Herriot, who completed a 100-hour development test on their version of the W-2B at a rating of 1,600 pounds thrust in May 1943. And on examination after this test, the engine was found to have only very minor defects. Further trials were carried out with an engine mounted in the tail of a Wellington flying test bed. And I'm sure some people here will remember those flying test beds. The story which went round of one of them with its jet going, which feathered one air screw, went on flying, feathered the second, went on flying. And the pilot of the nearby Spitfire nearly had apoplexy. Things went on. And with close cooperation and determined to succeed, the Rolls-Royce team at Clitheroe and Barnoldswick produced an increasing number of W-2B type engines, which are known as the Welland. Well, development work was continuing at Powerjet and, of course, very actively at Barnoldswick, and various problems were being faced up to, including turbine and compressor blade vibration. Powerjet's solution to the compressor blade vibration was this impeller with thickened tips, which made the tip much more vibration resistant, as you can see immediately by the strong section of material there, and fortuitously, I have to say, improved the aerodynamics as well. We'd gone on to design the best engine we ever produced, the W2700, which is shown here, and that had several important improvements in it, not least of which was what we call the Type 16 diffuser, which had straight tapering passages coming out to a corner vane under where the pointer is, and then turning into an axial further diffuser section, which went in axially into the reverse flow combustion chamber. And that, incidentally, avoided quite a lot of the eddies, which the earlier, what were called elephant trunk connectors, diffusers, had. So that engine, in fact, the aerodynamics of that were used by the Rolls team in the Derwent 5, which is shown here. You can see immediately the similarity of the diffuser structure, though the casing is different. The casing is made as a casting like that, whereas the power jet's casing was in two halves, corner vanes, and straight through combustion, which was a change which the Rover company brought in spite of the fact that it meant the engine had to have three bearings compared with the only two of the power jets. Well, this was a marvelous engine, and I won't say a word against it. The performance of the power jet W700 was actually slightly better, but I really don't think that amounted to very much. But with all the background and backing of Rolls-Royce, this engine, as you will all know, went into production for the Meteors and was operational for many years, and quite early on got the world speed record with Greenwood piloting, and many varieties of Meteor were built. Quite a number were sold to foreign countries, and it was altogether a very exciting thing. The sadness, as I said before, is that we didn't get the Meteor in the air sooner with the original W1 series engine, which I personally believe would have been quite good enough for that period. Of course, the performance with the W2B or the Derwent 5 was very much better. But bearing in mind, we could have had, there was a fuselage available in 1941, and we could have had it airborne then, and I think it would have been a very competitive aeroplane in 1941 with a much higher operational ceiling than anything else, any piston engine aircraft. However, that didn't happen, so there it is. Well, now, I'm going to now talk to something quite different. The Miles M52 project. In the autumn of 1943, the Ministry of Aircraft Production issued a specification for an aircraft to fly at 1,000 miles an hour at 36,000 feet altitude. The minister, Sir Stafford Cripps, favored the Miles company because it had produced unusual and enterprising designs. They were therefore awarded the contract to design and build an all-metal aircraft to break through the sound barrier. Miles was to evolve the airframe where power jets would produce a suitable gas turbine power plant. Whittle had in fact been one of the main advocates of a supersonic flight program. So, the basic shape of the aircraft was derived from a study of ballistics, and the design which emerged you will see in the video. But I must tell you that sadly, when the project was nearly ready for flying, the ministry cancelled it and the whole thing was lost. This slide illustrates the principle that was used. We had, first of all, the W2700 engine here with the turbine exhaust divided into an annulus like this, and then two stages of what the Americans call aft fan. I think many of you will have met that term, in which you have a turbine inside, a two-tier blade, and then a compressor blade on the outside, with, in this case, two rotor rows with stators in between. This Whittle called an augmenter, or thrust augmenter, to give it its full name, and that was being used in that short clip of video you saw. You were seeing the exhaust from this device, with the engine running, blowing around this augmenter, which, well, nearly tripled the air mass flow at very low pressure through the system, and then the afterburner in here, and some in the jet too, gave the tremendous flames you saw and the very much increased thrust. I mean, one has to say, it was a brute force and the ignorance way of doing it, but it was very light. And for an aircraft to prove that supersonic flight was possible, I think it was quite reasonable. The cancellation of the program really upset all of us in the team very much, and we thought that the excuse about the pilot was absolutely ridiculous, because several very competent pilots had volunteered to fly the prototype. And the whole thing had been laid out as a very sensible program, beginning with subsonic trials, I mean, even beginning with taxiing trials, but then going on to subsonic, and only finally attempting supersonic when it was known the aircraft was fully controllable and everything else worked. So I think, of course, there are always dangers in experimental flying, as you all know, but I don't think the dangers were nearly as high as the Air Ministry officials made out. So that was the sad end to that story. Another disappointment was the Power Jet's LR1 engine, and this is a sketch, and I rather wonder whether it was done by Mr. Bromhill. Did you do that? Yes, there we are. Yes. So, this was an attempt at a really long-range engine with it's a bypass engine. Fan here, which is gear-driven, then the main axial compressor, followed by a centrifugal stage, combustion, driven by a two-stage turbine, and then the exhaust with provision for variable geometry. That, I'm afraid, was equally badly treated by the Air Ministry, who cancelled the project and forbid us even to attempt to build and run the first prototype. So, when all these things happened, the morale of the place began to decline very seriously, and ultimately the team broke up in 1946. Now, I want to end on two postscripts. First of all, to say just a few words about the jet engine in Germany, which many of you will know quite a lot about. This remarkable slide from Stanley Hooker shows the inscription of Dr. Hans von Ohain, which he handed to Sir Frank Whittle on a German account of his aeroplane in the first flight, the equivalent to the E-28 in Germany. And you can, I hope, read it. It says, "To Sir Frank Whittle, in deep admiration of his great life's work, Hans von Ohain, 19th September 1966. Von Ohain, quite independently of Whittle, at least I've asked Whittle this question several times, and he says he's never been able to trace any connection, even though Whittle's patents were published in Germany between the wars. Out of his own resources, designed a back-to-back centrifugal compressor radial turbine engine, which initially he had to run on hydrogen because he found the combustion problem with oil so difficult. Then he was taken up by the Heinkel Company, who put a lot of resources into it, which led fairly quickly to the building of this aircraft, which in fact flew 21 months before the E-28. If there had only been some resources in oil development in this country, the position could have been reversed, but that wasn't to be so. As it happened, the German jet engines, the Junkers 004 and the BMW 003, which were fitted in the Messerschmitt airframe, the ME262, and the jet-propelled ME163, only entered squadron service at about the same time as the Meteor in the United Kingdom, and neither had a very major effect on the war. The great strength of the Whittle engine was it was simple enough to be a practical proposition at the time, yet advanced enough to form the basis of a whole new industry. Well, now, to conclude, could we have the lights, please? I would like to give you just some impression of what it was like to work at Pargett's, beginning with the very early days in 1940. As you will have seen, the conditions were incredibly rudimentary. We did a lot of dangerous things. Ridge Voisey, who later became our head of mechanical test, was boiling cordite under Whittle's room with a view of distilling fractions which would burn more slowly and would form a suitable cartridge for a starter for the Whittle engine. In fact, that problem was solved very simply because we were able to start the original prototype engine with the starter motor from the BSA car engine, which was used to crank it up. And we proceeded step by step, using less and less power until we found we could do that. The combustion test rigs were very dangerous, and Sir William Hawthorne, in a speech a few months ago, reported how he remembered testing the flows through the vaporizers by the amount collected in Imperial Dairy's milk bottles. And if the flow connected in the given time, which I think was 1 minute, reached the letter U of United Dairies, it was all right. Mighty scientific that was. But in spite of these limitations and the very crude conditions, I mean, the offices were perfectly dreadful in the first 2 years, but then everything improved after that, I must say that, when we got the Whetston offices. But in spite of that, we were very keen and tremendously loyal and appreciative of all Whittle himself contributed to the enterprise. In fact, my account throughout this lecture has been the story of the evolution of Frank Whittle's vision, which he first completed in his 20s, into the reality of jet-propelled flight. Turned down for 5 years by government and the aviation industry, he was finally given the chance through the initiative of two of his former brother officers, and I don't think enough credit has been given to Mrs. Williams and Tinling for what they did to get the development going. Whittle wrote in November 1988 to, as he then was, Sir Ralph Dudley Williams, that Williams' letter to Whittle in May 1935 is perhaps one of the most important letters in the history of engineering, in that it triggered a chain of events resulting in the successful development in Britain of the aircraft gas turbine and the widespread use of derived gas turbines in industrial and marine applications. With amazing persistence, in the face of every possible rebuff, Whittle had gone on applying his brilliant intellect to the possibilities of jet propulsion. By 1936, which was a year before his first engine ran, think of that, he had conceived and patented all forms of jet engine which we know today. The simple turbojet, the turbojet with reheat, the turboprop, the ducted fan, and the bypass engine. And that, in a single sentence, gentlemen, is the contribution of power jets to jet propulsion. It is indeed appropriate that the Queen appointed Sir Frank to this country's highest honor, the Order of Merit, in 1986. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm sure that lecture has stimulated lots of potential questions anyway, and Dr. Fielding is very willing to accept some questions tonight, and I'd like to open the meeting now for questions. Thank you. Yes?
Your personal reactions, Sir Sophocles, giving
I'm not sure that I can reply to quite all your questions, but I will certainly reply to the one about Stafford Cripps, which is very relevant. What happened was that Cripps, who I think was a very fair-minded man, wanted to see power jets at our Whetston works. And the thing I did, the visit was not very well staged marriage, in my view, because quite a lot of us technical people met him, and I had quite a talk with him myself on that occasion. But the visit ended with a session where Cripps spoke to the whole works labor force. And this was under the chairmanship of Mr. Allflat, the then works manager. And at the end of Cripps's talk, he, having not sort of warned anybody beforehand, none of us knew what was going to happen, he said, would any of the labor force like to respond to Sir Stafford? Well, our red-hot communist convener got up and said that he thought the company was largely managed, not to put too fine a point upon it. And there were one or two other grumbles, and then that session dissolved, broke up. Well, now, first of all, this was not true. I mean, all things are not perfect. They aren't in any organization, but certainly wasn't particularly badly managed. We did the best we could with a very scratched labor force and with inadequate resources until we moved to the Whetstone Works, where we did have adequate machine tools and test beds and so on. Anyway, Sir Stafford appointed a committee of inquiry under Sir Eric Mensforth, to which a lot of us gave evidence, and Mensforth came up with a proposal that Power Jets should be taken over by the government, who only paid a very small sum for it. I have the actual numbers, it was incredibly small, that it should henceforth be called Power Jets Research and Development Limited. It was given terms of reference which didn't sound too bad, and for the first year or so we were able to go on and go on and work on the LR1 engine and so on. But then things began to get worse and worse, and a lot of us got extremely worried about what was going on. The cancellation of the LR1 and the M52 projects were really the death knell of Power Jets as an independent company. And all the staff sort of began looking around and reading the advertisements and so on. And I moved to Ruston and Hornsby, others moved to English Electric and other companies. So that's my answer to that question. Now, what further ones would you like me to deal with?
There was one on handing over the things to America.
Yes. Well, that was again the same story. In its result, that our officials in the Air Ministry and MAP, Ministry of Aircraft Production, had really no commercial sense about the importance of this development. They simply gave it away, as Whittle himself said on the video.
Can we have the next question, please?
Oh, okay. Two questions, sir. One, did you ever buy the umbrella procedure, sir? Two, did you never get the feedback from the
3-4 Miles Enron Sub-Aircraft? Very interesting question. Quite frankly, I have no recollection of the umbrella thrust reverser. But I'm not saying categorically that it wasn't tested, but I had nothing to do with it. Because by that stage, I'd been moved to project design and was working on things like the LR1 and so on. And it prepared me very well for my later job when I designed my own gas turbine in anger, which, thank God, worked. It remained in production for 37 years. However, that's another story. The Miles Selector, no, I don't know much about this. I'm sure it's well written up in Don Brown's book about Miles Aircraft, which is a very interesting book indeed. I expect Whittle perhaps himself had some information for me, but it didn't get down to us in the engineering team. I would also like to pay tribute to R.C. McLeod, from whom I learnt most that I knew about engineering design until I got to Ruston's. And he was a perfectly remarkable man. He had a number of rather unrepeatable jokes, but he used to sit opposite me muttering, "Charolandos Christodoulon is a British subject." Now, having said that, it sounded unlikely. He would then say, the Trabzon Unterfeld Eisenbahn is very dangerous. For the overhead railway built over one of the rivers in the Ruhr. Anyway, he had a very graphic way of describing anything. At any moment I shall use some four-letter word that he would use regularly for describing engineering components. However, you are absolutely bearing out the feeling that until the decay at the end, when you've been sabotaged by so many people in the ministry, Partridge was a very happy, very constructive team going ahead. And I'm particularly grateful to you reminding me about those evening courses, that evening course, which you may remember I was unable to finish because the Admiralty asked me to go to Switzerland with a mission, and I got Mac Ogston to take over, who quite frankly was a much better lecturer than me on thermodynamics. He really knew it. I was having to revise it as the lectures went on.
Thank you. There's one question at the back. Premises in Lutterworth still existed.
No. They were knocked down about 2 years ago now. There are memorials in Lutterworth, so if you go there, you will find there's quite a large cast brass plaque on Lutterworth Town Hall. And there's also a statue of Sir Frank in Church Street, which is in fact the main street of Lutterworth, in a little garden that's there. And I went to see that a few months ago. It was in very good order, I'm glad to say. It actually has my name on it too, because he did me the honor of asking me to unveil it. And all that was done in 1987. But the test houses, a lot of us felt it was a national crime. They should have been preserved, the original test houses, where the W1 engine was developed. They were allowed to rot, and the doors were blowing in the wind and so on, and they were finally knocked down. And the special office block that was built for erecting engines on the ground floor and some engineering offices and a design office on the first floor, they were taken over by another company. That building, I believe, still stands, but you wouldn't know much about its part of its history.
Well, if there are no more questions, then I'd like to ask Harry Pearson, who's kindly volunteered, to give a vote of thanks tonight. Thank you, Harry.
Well, Bob, I cannot say what great pleasure it is for me to stand here and give thanks to you for this very interesting and, for me, nostalgic lecture. Next year, it'll be 50 years since we first met.
Yes, right.
Now, my pleasure would be even greater tonight if so many of the party that came to visit you were not pushing up daisies now. Yeah. Hooker, Lindsay Dawson in particular, who could be guaranteed to add humour to any situation,
absolutely,
very often unconsciously. Jeffrey Fawn, and of course, for some years now, Lombard.
Yes.
But of course, he wasn't in the party that I'm thinking of. Now, you have talked about working conditions at Lutterworth. But I'd give you a little bit of a slope on the working conditions, and this story comes from Whittle himself, so I'm not telling tales out of school. I think it was the Gloucester people let out in a visit that they referred to the offices there as the cherry orchard. Now, I'm sure all of you know that the Cherry Orchard is a play by Chekhov, very Russian, in which people dash on, make absurd or incomprehensible remarks, and then equally dash off. And they explained this to Whittle. They let out that this was it, you see. And he'd asked them why, and they said, well, you know, it's like that. People do that, and we call it a Cherry Orchard. It just reminds us of this play. Just at that moment, and here I'll interrupt you to tell, they'd for a long time put in a request for some blotters that you rock backwards and forwards, you know. This was before the invention of the biro, at least before the biro became available after the war. And they'd been put a request into these for a long while. You see, a dozen blotters was a very expensive thing for you. Anyway, somebody suddenly dashed in while they're having this meeting, Leslie Cheshire, I think, Rocking blotters. And then suddenly saw there was a meeting there, and he came and dashed out. Anyway, then they said, "You see what we mean?" Anyway, it was a good laughing point. The thing I'd like to add to what you talked about is this, that the overall concept, the courage in developing this engine, all those we acknowledge, all the people that I worked with at Barnoldswick had the greatest admiration for the PowerJets team. In fact, the first thing I said to Bobs and I was, I tremble to think why it's necessary if you can come and tell us of the contribution that you made. We already know. But it may not be so well known, the contribution that they made in the sort of details. Now, Hooker, for instance, thought Rolls-Royce were pretty good on superchargers. And there was no test of a Whittle supercharger until we fitted up a Vulcan test bed here and tested it for it.
Absolutely, yes.
And then it came out the damn compressor on the B, I'm not sure which number it was, but anyway, was better than the Merlin on efficiency. That didn't go down too well with Hooker, but anyway. Now, in the intakes to these engines, the air came in sort of in radially, flowing inwards and going round into the eye. And Whittle, his team had put chutes to guide the air in and swirl vanes to reduce the relative velocity which the air met the rotating vanes. Now, Hooker's contribution, which he got some credit for, was to throw all that rubbish away, as he said. And that's what we did, of course, on the first of the engines which we had design responsibility, and that was the Derwent 1.
Right.
And, of course, we lost a good deal of efficiency for it. And, in fact, my reputation in the early days consisted in gradually wearing down the opposition till we got them back again. And whether I got any real credit for it, I'm not sure, but certainly Hooker did. As he said, he's quite honest about it. I think he says so in his book, that he got a great deal of credit for taking them out, and even more credit for putting them back again in the knee. In fact, it reminds me of a story about Hooker much later on when he was talking to a young man from a university coming to work from that time at Bristol. He said, "You work hard here, and you'll be surprised how well I'll get on." Which shows at least he had a sense of humor, and he also had a very great... Anyway, the point I'm making is that the principles that he devised for that compressor, and I'm only using that as one example, showed how far ahead he was of the field. Once again, Bob, it's my pleasure to thank you for this. And I've enjoyed it immensely, and I say, full of nostalgia. Thank you very much.